I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In Washington this week, the news, of course, has been all about Iraq. And for the most part, the big story was shaped by the Bush administration. 2 days of congressional testimony by General David Petraeus and U.S. Ambassador to Iraq Ryan Crocker, carefully choreographed press conferences, and a primetime speech from President Bush last night all delivered pretty much the same message. It was one about progress. The surge is working. Give it time. Some American troops can be home in time for Christmas, but the bulk of U.S. forces will remain in Iraq for years to come. So the administration had its say in a big way this week. What now for Iraq policy? That question has now been kicked into Congress, and it's one that unsettles Democrats and a few Republicans as well. Joining us now is Rick Klein. He's senior political reporter for ABC News. And Rick, welcome.
Hi there.
You write that the Bush administration can feel good this morning but can't get cocky. Why not?
Well, I think they were having a really good week when General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker were before Congress on Monday and Tuesday. But by the time the president actually addressed the nation last night, I think things are shifting a little bit. And I think we hear some pushback from Republican moderates in Congress who say we're sick of the rosy assessments and the very optimistic look at where things are in Iraq. And we need to have more straight talk. We need to have an actual change in strategy. They did not hear a real change in strategy last night.
Well, I want to talk about what Congress can do, in particular the Democrats in Congress. But just want to run an idea by you. Earlier this week, you've probably read Washington Post military correspondent Tom Ricks has been giving interviews saying he thought the Bush administration really won the debate this week, that Democrats were caught essentially flat-footed without a strong answer to this administration's presentation during the week. Do you agree with that?
I do to some extent. I think that the week started with a big bang for Republicans, in part because MoveOn.org, the liberal group, took out, I think, an ill-advised ad that said, called General Petraeus, General Betrayus, and that really united the right. And I think Republicans felt really good on Monday, a little less good on Tuesday, a little less good on Wednesday, and by last night, they were starting to question whether this was as good a week as people thought. Although the headline out of the week, I think, is that the president bought time, and that's not a small accomplishment. The fact that we're going to be back here in March may be a good thing or bad thing for the Republican Party, but it is a good thing for the Bush administration, which really wants to have as much time, more time as possible.
Well, what happens in Congress now? In a way, this debate has been kicked into Congress, as we mentioned. I guess it shifts first of all to the Senate in particular. How is the debate going to play out there? What are the proposals being put forward?
Well, the Democrats would still like to mandate troop withdrawals on a timeline, a real time frame, and tie all funding to that time frame. They know, though, that they do not have 60 votes, the number to overcome a filibuster. They certainly don't have 67 votes, the number to overcome a veto. So the question for the Democrats is how much do they want to give to the moderate Republicans who will join them on some of these proposals? I think the likeliest proposal to get some traction is something that Senator Jim Webb from Virginia has proposed, and that's to put an actual cap on the amount of time that any troop can spend in the field of battle. That would have the effective impact of forcing a troop withdrawal more quickly than the president wants, because there aren't enough troops to go around. That's actually one of the reasons that the surge is going to unsurge and we're going to have more people coming home, is because they were scheduled to come home anyway. That is something the Bush administration opposes, to have an actual cap on the troop deployments. But it's something that I think Democrats can unite around and get Republicans on board to say, whatever we're doing over there, we shouldn't be overextending the members of the armed services.
And there are also proposals from Senate Armed Services Chairman Carl Levin and Jack Reed of Rhode Island. Can you give us a sense of what they're talking about?
Well, they would still like to have some kind of an orderly and planned withdrawal over a longer period of time. It becomes, though, very difficult to get any Republican support for things that go beyond an initial drawdown and go beyond the recommendations that General Petraeus is talking about. There still is enough support, I think, even in both parties, for the way that General Petraeus conducted himself to defer a bit to the military on these sort of things. The Reed Levin Amendment got close last time, and I don't think it's get there yet.
Rick Klein, thanks so much for joining us today. That's Rick Klein. He's a senior political reporter for ABC News. We're going to stick with the subject of Iraq for the next few minutes, and we're going to hear from Iraqis. As we mentioned, at the end of a long week when we've heard from the Bush administration on this subject, we thought it would be useful to check in with some Iraqis about their views on progress back home. What do they think about the war, about whether U.S. troops should stay, surge, or come home? What's the best way to restore some kind of order back home? Joining us first is Ayub Nouri. He's the faculty advisor to War News Radio, a weekly program produced by students at Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania. The program covers the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan through interviews with ordinary citizens of those countries. Welcome, Ayub.
Hi.
We first spoke to you last March. Tell us how this whole week of hearings and testimony and press conferences from the architects of U.S. policy has struck you.
The report that was released, or the David Petraeus' testimony in front of the Congress, really struck me, because I spoke to you last March, and since then, because I am from Iraq and I follow the situation in Iraq very closely with people that I know in Iraq, the situation has gotten worse and worse day after day. And now, after 6 months from March, David Petraeus and the American ambassador, Ryan Crocker, come out together with so much optimism and speaking of progress. And I have no idea where do they get this optimism from while the situation has been worse than what today is better than tomorrow. Mm. It is just, I call it baseless optimism.
Well, let's hear some tape from some of the Iraqis from your program, War News Radio, and talk a little bit about them. The first comes from a father living in Baghdad. Let's listen to this.
My name is Abdul Razak Mustafa. I am 38 years old. I am married and have 4 children. Most Iraqis do not see any progress in the situation. The streets of Baghdad become deserted at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Nobody dares to go out after that time. Even during the day, we cannot go to other parts of the city. More than 20 parts of Baghdad are impossible to visit. No one can go there unless if you're from a particular tribe or ethnic group. If you go to those areas, you might get killed, kidnapped, or robbed at any moment.
So Ayub, tell me, is that a pretty typical concern? Is that the kind of lack of progress that you're talking about?
That is absolutely, that Iraqi who spoke to us, I think absolutely portrayed the life in Baghdad and in Iraq these days. Because only if you can freely go around Baghdad to live your daily life, then in that case you can talk of progress and decline of violence in Iraq. And David Petraeus has prepared his report inside his office, inside the Green Zone, or inside his military base. If his report was prepared by a number of Iraqis who really live their lives in the streets of Baghdad and other cities, then we could put some trust in his report.
Well, let me bring another voice into this conversation. I'm happy to join in the studio Abdel Razak El Saidi. He's from Baghdad and worked with the New York Times in Iraq. He's now a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University. And Abdel Razak, welcome.
Thank you.
Abdel Razak, tell us what you heard this week, how you react to David Petraeus' report, General Petraeus' report, and the president's speech last night. Any sign of progress from what you hear back home?
I've been here in Boston just 3 weeks, so I can see there are progress. Maybe I disagree with my colleague, but how can you define this progress? You know, I can say it's not getting worse. In terms of the numbers or statistics of the car bombs, of the, you know, sectarian violence, of the assassinations, it's getting less. We realize that on the ground in Baghdad. But it's still very bad. People, they don't care. People now, they feel fed up, hopeless. It doesn't matter for them if you have 100 incidents a day and now you have 90. So what's the difference for them?
It's still an atmosphere of insecurity, essentially.
Yeah, if you talk to them, you said, what's the difference?
Ayub Nouri, it seems like, you know, one of the big points this week, of course, is the role of and the continued presence of American troops. What's your feeling about that?
Based on talking to Iraqis on the phone from here, they have told me that the surge has worked in those neighborhoods where the U.S. Troops are present in Baghdad. But as I am sure Abdul Razak knows, because he's from Baghdad as well, and he just arrived, Baghdad is a big city. I don't think the surge has a presence in every part of Baghdad. And there are parts of Baghdad that is completely out of control of the Iraqi government and the police and the Iraqi army. So the troop surge, first of all, several thousand of the troops went to Ramadi. They did not go to Baghdad directly. And it is not occupying the whole city of Baghdad. That's one thing.
You know, but if we just see the whole picture, I mean, of the surge, I mean, you know, we do not talk in details in every neighborhood, in every street. This is what's happened in that street or on that street in Baghdad. This is very detailed. Maybe you and I, we don't have this kind of details. But I'm as a journalist there, and part of my job. If you see to the whole picture, there are progress.
So you
Can
would
you
agree?
Tell me one of the progresses.
Well, it's the numbers. I mean, the numbers of the car bombs. You know, check. You know, how many car bombs the average? How many car bombs a day in 2006? And how many car bombs? You know, how many unknown bodies found in Baghdad after
but
you know after summer?
Let me tell you something. If the Al Qaeda or the insurgents or whoever they are, terrorists or whoever, I think that's their decision to decline the number of their car bombs. The Americans have never been able to stop one car bomb. As if we talk about the progress and the decline of number of car bombs, it means as if the Americans were those who were behind the car bombs. And now, hey, there's progress and there is no more car bomb and they have decreased. Those people who prepare the car bombs are unknown people. So when it increases or when decreases, it's their decision.
But Ayub Nouri, let me ask you about that. I mean, in places where perhaps the number of car bombs has decreased or where the number of U.S. troops have increased, hasn't that brought about a certain amount of stability? And isn't the question what happens when this surge discontinues? Can the progress that General Petraeus was talking about be sustained?
That is one important thing. That's true. And I sound very angry here, and my anger is not necessarily directed at the Americans. I know their troop surge has worked in some neighborhoods, and I know people in some neighborhoods of Baghdad are happier if they are patrolled by a unit from the U.S. Army than by a unit from the Iraqi army or the police, because they don't trust the Iraqi army or police. But my anger is directed at the Iraqi government for not having an alternative. This troop surge is not going to continue for the rest of life. They have to one day withdraw. And what does the Iraqi government have in the basket to replace or to do once those American troops leave? It might be a solution, but for how long?
I don't think we will live in peace or stability in the short time, even if the search will continue or not continue. Because the problem, it's too complicated to be solved by, 30,000 troops, you should send to the Iraq. So it's main part of the solution, it's political. And so far, according to the leaders, political leaders in Iraq now, from different blocs, I don't see we will have a real reconciliation.
That dim outlook on possible reconciliation in Iraq from Abdul Razak al-Saidi. He's an Iraqi journalist and a current Nieman Fellow this year at Harvard. We're also joined by Ayub Nouri, an Iraqi journalist from Kurdistan, now working as a faculty advisor to War News Radio, a radio program produced by students at Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with him and consider the role of the Iraqi government and whether the only way forward for Iraq is to partition the country among the various ethnic groups. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. We're back with our guests, Ayub Nouri, an Iraqi journalist who works as a faculty advisor to War News Radio, a student radio program at Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania, and Abdul Razak al-Saidi, another Iraqi journalist, and this year a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University. And before we took a break, we were talking about the possibility of broad political reconciliation in Iraq. Ayub, what are the prospects of that?
I don't think that happens in a foreseeable future because it's a disintegrated political process and the Iraqi politicians do not trust each other. If they trusted each other for one second, then we would have seen at least some progress since 2003 until now. Since 2003, the insurgency has increased, the situation has been deteriorating continuously, and the Iraqi government has not had any progress in Iraq. It means, I believe, they do not trust each other. And one other thing about the Iraqi government is that they are dishonest with themselves, with the Iraqi people, with the neighboring countries, and even with the United States. They have this habit of blaming one thing on Iran, the other thing on Saudi Arabia, some of the U.S. troops, and only now, even now, another evidence is that as American President Bush or the U.S. authorities are to some extent angry with the Iraqi government, every day Maliki comes on the TV and directs the anger back at the Americans. It's the sign that they are busy with whatever they want to do. Mm. They have to be honest with everyone and tell the world what they want to do, to stay in one Iraq, or to do partition, or to work together to keep Iraq together. Nobody knows what they are doing.
Well, speaking of progress, let me return again to a point that was made this week by both President Bush and General Petraeus. They spoke a great deal about Anbar province and the success that has occurred there. They talked about Sunni tribal leaders deciding to fight al-Qaeda forces, taking the initiative, coming to the U.S. for help. And both President Bush and General Petraeus talked about that's the kind of success that could be repeated across Iraq. Do you think that's possible, Abdul Razak? I mean, and was that a fair point that they made based on what you've observed in Iraq?
Yeah, it was very fair points. If you just have a look about what's going on in Anbar province and how the tribal leaders now, they are really fighting al-Qaeda. Also in Diyala province, it's the same thing happened. Although yesterday, the assassinations of the Sheikh
Abdul Sattar
Al-Burishi. It was, I mean, I don't know what to say, but it was very strong message.
This Sheikh was one of the leaders of that alliance, and he was killed in a roadside bomb yesterday. Ayub Nouri, talk to me a little bit about Anbar province and this claim that this might be an example of how progress could be sustained across the whole country.
I think I am happy if people in Iraq realize that it is wrong to ally with insurgents, with al-Qaeda, with all of these criminals and terrorists who call themselves resistance or whatever. It's a good idea, but I hope the sheikhs in Diyala or in Anbar do not ally with themselves with the U.S. Only because they are realized al-Qaeda is weak or the insurgents is weak. That's a tragedy if they ally with the Americans or with the Iraqi government only if they find one of those in the position of power. That's one thing. And one other thing, from day first, I haven't agreed and I haven't been happy about the Americans arming and funding those tribes in Iraq, because most of the weapons that have been used against the Americans and against the Iraqi government in the past 4 years were weapons that were given to those tribes and to Iraqis by Saddam Hussein. And in the future, those same weapons might fall in the hands of people who will not agree with the Iraq's future government, Iraq's future constitution.
I was struck this week by an administration that was essentially putting forth a case for sustaining the current policy in Iraq, and by an opposition in the United States Congress, the Democrats, that didn't really seem to offer an alternative. What should the future plan be?
I think I do not blame the Americans if they do not have an alternative plan or an exit strategy, because you cannot clap with one hand. The Americans cannot do alone. What about the Iraqi government? Why should we always speak about the Americans, oh, they don't have a plan, or this is what they should, this is what they shouldn't do? It is the matter of Iraq. We are talking about Iraq. We are talking about a population of over 20 million people, and with a symbolic Iraqi government that has been placed in Baghdad since 2003 and has not been able to do anything. And they should come up with a plan for after the U.S. troops, because U.S. troops will pull out whether we like it or not. They will one day pull out.
Abdul Razak, you were mentioning how different this country is from one end to the other. You told me an interesting story a moment ago before we started about the different reactions to the capture of Saddam Hussein that you covered. Can you talk about that a little bit?
When Saddam was captured in December 2003, I went with one of New York Times correspondent to the Shia area in Baghdad, which is called Karada. And we covered the reaction of the people. And the people there were so happy and so excited, dancing in the street, shooting the air, throwing the candy because Saddam was captured. Some people, they were crying because they are so happy. I went to Fallujah morning, which Fallujah is a Sunni town in Anbar province. And what I've seen there, it's completely different to what I've seen in Karada. I've seen people, kids, women, sheikhs, carrying Saddam's picture, praising Saddam. From that moment, and this is in 2003, then I said, am I now living in one country, in one people?
Ayub Nouri, Abdul Razak is telling a pretty compelling story about a case for partition in Iraq. a Shiite state, a Sunni state, and a Kurdish state in the north. Is this the only way to go in the long run?
I totally agree with Abdulrazak. It is difficult or almost impossible for these people with these different affiliations and tendencies to live in one country. And I believe the majority of the Iraqi politicians who are Shias and Kurds these days would like the idea of partition. But why they don't say it, I don't agree with partition in the first place. But if that's the only solution, please do it and tell the world. They say, oh, let's not talk about partition. Iran would be upset. Turkey will be upset.
Yeah,
Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
Don't speak about those things. Save the Iraqi people. Don't think about what your neighboring countries think.
Well, gentlemen, thank you both very much for coming in and talking to us today. Abdulrazak El-Saidi worked with the New York Times in Iraq. He's now studying at Harvard University as a Nieman Fellow. Abdulrazak, thank you.
Thank you.
And we heard from Ayub Nouri, who's an Iraqi journalist from Kurdistan in northern Iraq and now heading War Radio News at Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania. Ayub Nouri, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And to hear War News Radio, go to our website, hear-now.org. You're listening to Here and Now. You've probably heard the story before, read it in a newspaper, or watched it on a movie screen. A man is convicted of a heinous crime, is sent to prison, where he finds religion and turns his life around. Well, now it may be more difficult for federal prison inmates to find religion, all because of a new directive from the Federal Bureau of Prisons. The new rules require prisons to rid their chapel libraries of all religious books, tapes, CDs, and videos that are not on a list of approved resources. The Prison Bureau says it's following recommendations from the Justice Department to remove materials that in the wake of 9/11 would, quote, discriminate, disparage, advocate violence, or radicalize. So across the nation, chaplains have been purging prison chapel libraries of thousands of unapproved texts. Joining us now is Mark Early, president of Prison Fellowship, a Christian group that ministers to inmates and helps prepare them to reenter society. And Mark Early, welcome.
Thanks. It's great to be with you.
Now, I've done a little reading before talking to you. You've likened this move by the Prison Bureau to swatting a fly with a sledgehammer. Tell me why.
Well, I have. I mean, there is a fly that needs to be swatted. There is some isolated instances of extremist literature in prison chapel libraries. The Inspector General's report done by the Attorney General's office found there were some extremist Islamic literature that advocated hate and violence. But the way to deal with that is simply to remove those offending pieces. What the Bureau of Prisons has done is swat this fly with a sledgehammer. They're requiring all chapel libraries in every federal prison in the United States to get rid of every book they have, to either give them away, store them, or destroy them, and only keep an approved list which they have set, and it's 150 books.
Hmm.
And we think there's just a lot more sensible and rational way about to go about this.
Well, before we get into what literature is deemed acceptable by the Bureau of Prisons, remind us how it worked in the past. Were you able to bring in whatever religious literature or materials you wanted to prisons and have them placed in the prison library?
Well, basically, the way chaplains have built up their libraries over the years is various faith communities have donated books to the chapel library. So churches, synagogues, mosques have donated literally hundreds of thousands of books to chapel libraries over the years. And, you know, 99.9% of those books are fine, and they fall within acceptable guidelines.
So now the Prison Bureau will accept only pre-approved materials from a list of 150 books, 150 audiovisual materials for 20 different religions from what it calls its standardized chapel library project list. Can you characterize what's on that list?
Well, what they did is they pulled together what they call a subject of a group of religious subject matter experts. And, for example, for the Christian library, they identified 150 books. And they said, any books that you have in your chapel library of the Christian faith that's not on this list, you've got to get rid of. And it's not that the list is a bad list. That's not the problem. The problem is they're getting rid of literally hundreds of thousands of other books that are fine as well, that have helped inmates, books, tapes, CDs, etc. And we think a lot saner approach would have been to allow chaplains to review their libraries, given certain guidelines, anything that preaches violence or hatred, get rid of it. Mm-hmm. And that would have been the easy thing to do. That's what they do in their regular libraries.
Do we know who the Bureau of Prisons consulted when it compiled this new list?
Well, they certainly got legal advice from the Department of Justice, and then they put together a group of what they called religious subject matter experts. Who those individuals were, I don't know.
And I gather some people, I dare say you might be among them, are concerned about First Amendment issues here. I've noticed that a Christian as well as an Orthodox Jew are suing the government, claiming their rights to exercise their religion under the Constitution's First Amendment are being violated. Do such cases have merit in your view?
It may very well have merit. I do think there's religious freedom of religion issues here for inmate as well as First Amendment issues. I think the larger issue, quite frankly, is a policy issue, and that is, we have incarceration rates now that are the highest ever in our nation. One out of every 32 American adults are either in prison or on probation and parole. Two-thirds of them that get out of prison are rearrested within 3 years, and 50% are back in prison. This is not the time to be diminishing the rehabilitative sources that are available to prisoners. This is a time to be increasing them. And it's ironic and it's unfortunate that at this time in the nation's criminal justice history, we'd be shrinking the amount of faith-based books that are available to prisoners to change their lives.
Now, the Prison Bureau says that prayer books and other worship materials are not affected by its new policy. So, I mean, I guess a basic question is, why do you need books other than, say, the Bible or the Quran? I mean, what's missing, in other words? What's not on this list?
Well, I think biographies, for example, of people inspire you to see what you can become. People who have had to face the challenges of drug abuse or changing criminal behavior. A lot of religious books are testimonies about how other people in similar situations in prison who've run afoul of the criminal justice system have turned their lives around. Some of the great inspirational books down through the ages, St. Augustine's Confessions. Books are important in changing lives and helping people see what they can become.
I guess where I was going with that question specifically about specific books, I mean, are there examples of specific books that you know are not on the list that sort of make the argument that this list is not a good idea?
Well, I've looked at the list that they picked. It's a good list. Anybody would like to have it in their library. But I know that many of those books are books that religious subject matter experts may feel are good books. But for a prisoner often needs something different or in addition to what may be considered a historical work. They may need something that was written within the last 6 months by somebody who was in a prison in another part of the country who's gotten out of prison and doing well with their life, that was self-published. So the point is not that the 150 books are bad or that there may be some isolated good books that aren't on the list. The point is, in order to solve a problem with a few isolated instances of extremist literature, it makes no sense to have chapel libraries get rid of hundreds of thousands of volumes that otherwise are available to inmates, have shown to help inmates, and have been read by inmates for years and years.
Well, Mark Early, thanks so much for talking to us about this today. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
Mark Early is president of Prison Fellowships, a Christian ministry group founded by Chuck Colson, an aide to former President Richard Nixon. Colson pled guilty to his role in the Watergate scandal and converted to Christianity while in prison. We've been talking about the Federal Bureau of Prisons' new approved-only list of religious literature in prison chapel libraries. And for the record, the Bureau of Prisons declined our invitation to be interviewed on its new policy, but a Bureau spokesman did tell us that St. Augustine's Confessions is on its approved list. And just a reminder, you can hear today's show on our website, here-now.org. For past programs, click on the archives, and you can download a podcast and take us with you wherever you go. That's here-now.org. And before we go today, Across the Universe, the new film uses Beatles music to tell a tale of the 60s, and it leaves our rock and roll critic a little uneasy. You're listening to Here and Now. And And now to a story about crime and punishment and how the powerful cheat and sometimes pay a price. Now, we're not talking about Richard Nixon or Bill Clinton. We're talking about the National Football League. In this case, the NFL has fined New England Patriots coach Bill Belichick $500,000, which I guess is about a week's pay, and his team another $250,000 for using a video camera to try to steal signals from opposing coaches during last Sunday's game against the New York Jets. Here to talk about football's Cheatgate and the rest of the week in sports is Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. And Bill, as always, good to have you in.
Well, it's good to be here, Anthony.
Well, so I am shocked, cheating in professional sports. Oh, my God. And yet, seriously, I guess this does take some of the shine off of the New England Patriots and their great coach, Bill Belichick.
Well, if hiring Randy Moss didn't take some of the shine off the Patriots, Randy Moss bringing baggage, felonious and otherwise, and if Rodney Harrison's suspension for using illicit substances to enhance his performance didn't take the shine off the Patriots, I suppose it's time to stop talking about the New England Patriots as the most admirable franchise in the history of capitalism. Mm.
Do we think that this sort of behavior is widespread, though, across the NFL?
It depends on who you listen to. Yeah. Some people certainly say that it is, and of course other people who have been bitter about the success of the Patriots for years say that this is the worst single act ever committed.
Hmm.
Anywhere, by anyone.
By anyone, right. Wow. And there's a lot of acts to choose from there. Okay, let's move on. It's that time of year. Let's talk about Major League Baseball, the wild card race. In the American League, you've got the Angels of Los Angeles, 8.5 games ahead of second place and slumping Seattle. Cleveland leads Detroit by 5.5 games, and the Red Sox enjoy the same advantage over the Yankees, but that could change one way or another this weekend when the Yankees come to Fenway. This rivalry never seems to end, does
it?
Well,
as you say, it will change because they don't let baseball games end in ties, except for the odd All-Star game, of course. The Yankees are too far behind. They're going to finish second in the division, but they're going to win the wild card. The Red Sox will win the division, and then we'll go into the playoffs and let the wild rumpus begin.
We'll see. I'm interested that you can go out on a limb like that. I mean, say
it's
the
a
Yankees,
pretty thick limb at this point. 5.5 games.
The
with
Yankees
this much time
sweep.
Left.
They're 2.5 games up, and then with what 12 games left to play?
Well you are a real Red Sox fan, aren't you?
Okay, so much for the national pastime. Let's move on to a subject near and dear to your heart: soccer. Bill, you just told me before we started this that you got up this morning to watch a particular soccer game because apparently you get too much sleep.
Well, I was worried that the U.S. team had tied their first game. They won their second game against Sweden 2-0, and that was great. And then the following game, I watched a little bit of the following game before I came in, and England was brilliant, holding off Germany, defending World Cup champs, which is interesting because before this year, England had been rather lightly regarded in the world of women's soccer. They now have this midfielder, Kelly Smith, who's just a wonderful player. And if things break right at the end of the first round, they may very well go through.
English women's soccer, yeah, it doesn't exactly roll off the tongue very easily as sort of a great soccer power.
No, they're sort of attached to the teams we have heard of, the Arsenals and Man Uniteds of the world, but nobody has paid too much attention to them in the past, and I think that may be about to change.
And finally, condolences to our listeners in Portland, Oregon, on news that first-round draft pick Greg Oden will have to sit out his first year as a Trailblazer after exploratory surgery revealed cartilage damage in his right knee. Another bad break for a team that seems to be jinxed when it comes to first-round draft picks, right?
Well, I really hope not. I mean, what I've read about this suggests that the surgery is they expect a very good outcome from this surgery, and so that it'll be a hiccup rather than a career-ending experience, and that Oden will help Portland to all sorts of success somewhere down the line.
Hmm. Okay. Well, Bill Littlefield, thanks for coming in today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for coming. Bill Littlefield covers sports and more each week on NPR's Only a Game. Still to come, we go across the universe with a new film that uses Beatle music to resurrect the 60s. That's still to come. Here and now. The new film, Across the Universe, begins simply enough. A forlorn-looking young man, played by Jim Sturgess, sits on a beach, looks at the camera, opens his mouth, and sings.
Is there anybody going to listen to my story? All about the girl who came to stay.
The song, of course, is Girl by the Beatles. Here it's sung by Jim Sturgess, who plays the character Jude, which should clue you in. Across the Universe is a musical film set in the 60s with scenes of young love, student protests, and the Vietnam War told almost entirely through the words and music of the Fab Four. But as we just heard, the music is rearranged and sung by others. Across the Universe comes from director Julie Taymor, who won Tony Awards for directing and designing costumes for Broadway's The Lion King. She was also a recipient of a MacArthur Genius Grant. So was the idea of building a film around Beatles music an act of genius? To consider that, we're joined by Here and Now's rock critic Tim Riley. Tim is the author of Tell Me Why, The Beatles Album by Album, Song by Song, The 60s and After. And Tim, tell us more about the premise of the film Across the Universe.
The premise is a coming-of-age romance between a young British man and his American girlfriend. And that's where it all starts to unravel. And I would call this movie kind of a noble failure because it is so wildly imaginative and it does take so many really creative chances with all this music. And yet it is so over the top and so wrong-headed in some of its choices that you just have to wonder how some of it got through it, and some of it just doesn't work. There's a couple things that work really well. Early on in the movie, we hear I Want to Hold Your Hand sung as a ballad, kind of slowed down, which is a very risky choice to make for such a familiar song. And I think they actually get away with it. I think that's one of the songs that works actually pretty well.
Yeah, I'll tell you something. I think you'll understand when I say that something. I wanna hold your hand. I wanna hold your hand.
What else worked in terms of the music?
Well, one of the sequences in the movie, and there's a lot of these sequences that are kind of psychedelic and magical, and, you know, some of that's done really well. One of the sequences that I like that's not getting very well reviewed is Bono, the U2 singer, and he is cast as this character named Dr. Robert, who's kind of a Ken Kesey figure, and he sings I Am the Walrus. But he sings it with a kind of deadpan, reverse charisma, not a lot of energy, kind of as though the song is just direct reporting. And I think it works actually kind of well. And I have to say, I'm not a Bono fan.
Elementary boy when singing Hare Krishna, man, you should have seen him kicking Edgar Allan Poe. I am the Eggman. They are the Eggman. I am the Walrus.
So, Tim, a story about the 60s, about the era when the Beatles were all the rage in the 60s. Do they actually show up in the movies?
Well, that's one of the things that I think is curious about the movie, is that there's this giant hole at the center of the movie. Everyone is turning around and launching into a new Beatles song, but you have to remember that in the 60s, the Beatles were a central piece of everyday life. Any characters who were going to college and joining student revolutions in the 60s would have been listening to Beatle albums and discussing the Beatles a lot of the time, and these characters don't do that. It's almost as like rock and roll is this extra thing that's added on after they all go through their experiences, when really rock and roll was right at the center of things and inspiring a lot of people's thoughts and behavior.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the music. I read that the film uses the song I Want You as part of a recruiting poster.
Right.
How did that work in your view?
I didn't like that, and it's starting to show up on some blogs as something that people aren't liking. And Julie Taymor gets quoted as saying, you know, she thinks this is one of the clever breakthroughs of the movie because, you know, the title of the song, the refrain of the song, is actually literally the thing that was on recruitment posters for the Army.
I want you. I want you so bad. I want you. I want you so bad.
It's one of the sequences in the movie that's too clever by half, because you realize, oh, yeah, that really is the line on the poster. But then Uncle Sam comes to life and reaches out of the poster and grabs young Max. The thing that ruins it for me is that all of the American soldiers that he starts to dance with are done up in what looks to me like it's not like American soldier garb. It looks like he's joined the Cuban Revolutionary Army.
Curious. What about this idea? I want to go back to something you touched on right at the beginning, this whole idea of using Beatles music to tell a story. The Beatles mean so much to so many people of a certain age, let's say. It seems like this is incredibly risky.
Well, yeah, that's the thing, is it is really risky. I mean, the fact that they're all named after Beatle characters.
Yeah, I wanted to say, I was just looking at some of the notes. You've got Jude. There are other characters whose names come right out of Beatle songs. Max, Lucy, Sadie. Is she sexy? Prudence, dear Prudence, on and on.
Yeah, you know, it just, and after a while, it just gets kind of tired. It's just tired and obvious. And, you know, the way that movie starts with the guy sitting alone on a beach singing, I mean, you can hear his singing. It's over dramatic, it's emphatic. And if one thing that was great about Beatle material was the way they just sort of hung back. Sort of, they knew they had great material. They didn't need to over enunciate and, you know, be insistent.
She's the kind of girl you want so much it makes you sorry. Still you don't regret a single day. Ah, girl.
Well, as we said, Julie Taymor won a MacArthur Genius Grant. She's directed the highly acclaimed production of The Lion King, which is still running on Broadway. Do you see that kind of success, notwithstanding your concerns about this film?
No, I think the film will open okay, because obviously there's a huge Beatle audience out there still curious to go and see it. And the soundtrack to this thing is not going to disappoint people. They put it on their stereo and it's going to be, you know, this is a lot better than many other treatments of Beatle material we've heard. But as a movie, it really just does not hold together. And it's got me thinking differently about Julie Taymor. Maybe her strength is as a production designer and a choreographer. But Lion King, nobody's lining up to see Lion King because of the story.
Of course, this isn't the only recent project involving the Beatles. There was the short-lived musical Imagine, based on the music of John Lennon. Cirque du Soleil's Love has been running in Las Vegas. Why does this music continue to inspire this kind of treatment, this kind of effort, this kind of tribute, if you will?
Well, the music is obviously just a core piece of the baby boomers' coming-of-age myth. I mean, it's central to any story that you're going to tell about the 60s, and it's so inspired and well-built that it does really lend itself to all this repackaging, and, you know, people just can't get enough of it. It's almost like the direct experience of it in the 60s just wasn't enough. We just got to have more and more and more.
Well, the film is Across the Universe, and Tim Riley is the author of Tell Me Why. He's also working on an upcoming book on John Lennon. And Tim Riley, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Words are flowing out like endless rain into a paper cup. They slither while they pass, they slip away across the universe.
You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.